And actually, I call it the Femi test. So our consultant in ED, Femi, he walked in. He said, "Hi, Nick, how are you doing?" I started talking, started coughing. He said, "Well, you've got it." And it was, I thought that's a pretty sensitive test for someone who's seen dozens and dozens of patients come through. He just said, "That's the one." Anyone who knows anything about this virus says that the moment you think you know what it's going to do, it does something else. It's really unpredictable. So the more people, the more data we get, the better we can treat it. The longer we get down this path, the more we're going to know about the immunity from it. But until we actually have that, we have to be safe.
Welcome back to BLA Connections, A Clear Voice. I'm your host, Natalie Watson, and I'm delighted to bring you discussions and insights from experts from across the globe on all things laryngology. Our first series brought you information, discussions, and perceptions on COVID-19 and laryngology. We will revisit a lot of what we covered, and we will endeavour to provide more information and how we move forward as we navigate out of the pandemic and what this will mean for our specialty and how we will practice today and into the future and potentially into the second wave. In today's episode, we will be discussing the patient experience of COVID-19 and the transition from surgeon to patient with Nicholas Gibbons, consultant laryngologist and head and neck surgeon in the University Hospital, Lewisham in South London, where we had the first case of COVID in the UK. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolute pleasure. Lovely to be here.
Brilliant. Well, let's crack on and go straight for our first question. Early on in the COVID-19 pandemic, you contracted the infection. Can you talk us through your experience?
Yeah. So this was in mid-March. And this was really when everyone's recognition of the virus was being alerted to it. And we were realizing that this was spreading very rapidly. And numbers in the hospitals are starting to just creep up. We'd seen it in Europe. It hadn't quite hit the UK yet, but we knew for sure there were cases in the UK. Now, on a Friday morning, I normally do a laryngology list, operative list, and that involves some microlaryngoscopy tubes. It involves some CO2 lasers. It involves some jet ventilation and some Thrive apneic ventilation. So I've got a variety of different airway management schemes depending on the pathology the patient is being operated on for. But what it also means is there's a whole load of what we now know, sort of aerosol generating procedures and jets sort of spreading aerosols and droplets around the place. Now, although I wear a mask, it certainly wasn't a sort of PPE and I wasn't wearing full kit as we would do nowadays. And the reason I mention all that is I'm convinced that I have picked up the infection from one of those cases. I have no doubt in my mind at all. And we were really all watching the news. And on a Saturday, which was the 15th, I think, of March, 14th, 15th, something like that, we were watching the news, and Italy numbers were really bad. And we were watching this with some trepidation, thinking it's coming our way. And I developed a bit of a cough. And of course, half of me is thinking, it's just a bit of a cough. Half of me is thinking, oh my God, it's the end of the world. I've got COVID and it's all going to go horribly wrong. But I felt otherwise pretty well. So it got to Monday morning and this cough really hadn't shifted. And I maybe had a low-grade fever, 38 or less. But it would certainly in the past had not ever have stopped me going to work. And I was thinking, well, look, I'm an airway surgeon. I'm probably going to be needed at work. Because I'd heard from a colleague of mine who was in intensive care that actually the first patient had come in on the Friday, and then on the Saturday, 20 patients came in, intensive care was full, HDU was full, and I thought probably airway surgery is something that they're going to have use for. So I went in on the Monday morning. The advice was spread around the trust prior to this. It said, if you have a cough, do not come into hospital. So I didn't go into hospital, but I went to what they called the COVID command center and kept my distance and, you know, just wanted to make sure everything was fine and people felt safe with me standing there with a bit of a cough. And I said, look, this is the situation. I've got a bit of a cough. I feel fine. Normally I'd go to work. Is there any possibility of getting a test? And if that's negative, then I can come back to work. And because you're going to need an airway surgeon. And they said no, basically. They just said, well, we haven't got the test. Because that was back in the day. If you remember back to March, we were struggling to get PPE. We didn't have the tests. We were trying to scrabbling around, trying to get them from other countries because we just didn't have them. And that was the real drive at that point. So frustrated as I was, because I wanted to get stuck in, I wanted to help, you know, I had some expertise that could be useful in this situation. But I had to go home. So I went home and I had to isolate for 2 weeks. As it was, the decision for me to isolate was a very good thing, because over the next few days, I developed a bit of a temperature, again, not very much, but definitely things weren't, I wasn't shaking this virus off in the way that one would normally shake a sort of an upper respiratory tract infection off over a few days, and what I would expect to happen. And about a week after, so we're now talking, I think the UK locked down on the 23rd of March, which was the Monday, and it was about then I was thinking, actually, I'm struggling quite a lot. I wasn't able to speak a full sentence without coughing. I just thought a sort of a hypersensitive cough reaction, and I was definitely feeling some tightness in the chest. And I thought, well, maybe it's a bit of reflux. I've had that in the past. So I treated myself for that with the Gaviscon and the usual measures. It wasn't making any difference at all. And I live in a kind of thin terraced house, and we have lots of stairs. And I've got two young girls, and they live right on the very top. And often we'd be running up and down stairs all day. And normally I do that without any problems at all. I keep myself fit anyway. And that's not a problem. And I was finding that the stairs were getting more and more troublesome, and I was starting to get very puffed out. And it came to a head about 9 or 10 days after I first developed a cough, where I walked slowly up two flights of stairs, and then I had to stop and sit down and really take a few minutes and get my breath back. And I thought, this is obviously not right. And I said, well, look, this probably is COVID. So at that point, I thought, look, I better get this checked out. GPs weren't seeing anyone, so I thought A&E is probably the right place, but I didn't want to burden the system. So I rang up some colleagues at the hospital and said, look, what should I do here? Should I come into A&E? And they said, for goodness sake, just come in. We'll get you checked. Make sure that there's nothing serious going on. So I went to A&E. They were great. And actually, I call it the Femi test. So our consultant in ED, Femi, he walked in. He said, hi, Nick, how are you doing? I started talking, started coughing. He said, well, you've got it. And it was, I thought that's a pretty sensitive test for someone who's seen dozens and dozens of patients come through. He just said, that's the one. Yeah, you've got it. I had resting SATs of about 96%. And then I walked around the nurse's station a few times, and it dropped down to 92. And I was feeling really short on air. And I've described it previously as I felt like my body was working at about 90% and my lungs were working at about 50%. And, you know, these in comparison, of course, are mild, moderate, mild symptoms, really, not even moderate. And I was fine and I got away with it, bearing in mind that, you know, lots of patients had really, really troublesome times. And some, you know, lots of our colleagues have died because of this. ENT surgeon, ophthalmologist, and a number of different specialties. So I have in no doubt that, you know, I got off very mildly. It was a rough ride for a little while. And then it peaked at about day 10, shortly after I'd gone to A&E, actually, and really kind of dropped off quite rapidly after that. But I reckon I didn't feel completely normal for 6 weeks. And then there were still little bits and bobs of sort of fatigue and things that kept rearing its head just temporarily over the following month or two. So it really took a while, and that was for mild symptoms. So I think that's really made me appreciate people who've had really bad COVID and have come out the other side, and how much they struggle.
Absolutely. I mean, hats off to everybody who's had COVID and who's managed to get through it. We were really shocked And I think I was particularly shocked at how affected you'd been, because I'd always looked at you as someone so fit, and you're such an ultra fit chap doing all sorts of things, representing GB and the obstacle course racing.
Yeah.
It's absolutely amazing. And for you, the fittest man on earth, to then be shut down and short of breath and desaturating just blew my mind. And it was really actually that kind of brought it home to me that anybody could be affected by COVID and the COVID pneumonitis.
Yeah, it was a really interesting reaction, because I posted a bit of stuff on social media, including some sort of non-medical sort of exercise groups that I'm part of, and everyone was very interested, because it wasn't the sick and the vulnerable who get this. I mean, they do, but it's everyone can get this, and it will affect you, and it is not a nice virus to have. You know, and a lot of people do get very mild symptoms, and that's great and that's wonderful. But just because you're fit as a fiddle does not mean that you aren't going to have trouble with this thing. And I think putting it out there was a really good thing to do. And I got a lot of very positive feedback for that. What I've also said was about 3 or 4 weeks after I initially got it, I thought, you know, I might just start doing some light exercise. I just didn't feel like doing anything at all. I was doing Joe Wicks with my kids in the morning. And the first time I did Joe Wicks, I lasted 2 minutes, and I just had to stop. And I just, that, for me, again, that brought home to me, I just thought, that's how far down the road I'd gone. And I can't do what I can normally do, not even a fraction of it. So yeah, it made me realize, I think more in retrospect, when I tried to do my normal stuff, just physically couldn't do it. Mm. It made me realize in retrospect that, you know, I really was not in a great shape, even though in comparison, as I said, it was a fairly mild symptoms compared to others.
And hats off to you. You've also just really stuck at kind of getting fit again, and that kind of rehabilitation focus has been brilliant. And you got back into work very quickly. So, yeah, so well done. Let's just talk about really how your journey from surgeon to patient, how did it change your outlook on kind of COVID-19 infection and also its effect on our society?
Yeah, it's been really interesting. And I think this will resonate with any doctor who's had a medical issue of any description, is that you do become just much more interested in it. It's no longer a theoretical disease process that you read in a book. It's something that you can intimately relate to. So I've been not so much in terms of how to treat COVID, or you know, how I can, as an ENT surgeon or a laryngologist, help, because actually that's fairly limited. The way we can help is primarily with sort of airway management. But then secondarily, as we're finding out now more about the secondary effects, long-term effects of COVID in and around the larynx and the airways, but actually more in terms of, I got really into sort of the epidemiology of it, just following the numbers. And you, once you really look at the numbers in detail and in large numbers and follow the patterns as they spread across the world, and watch how they spread around in hot spots. For example, when it went to America, really New York got hammered, and then you can see the hot spots in a way that previous pandemics we just haven't had the computing power to do. I found that fascinating, and the more information you get, the more you realise, you know, we're so close to it just erupting again, and we're at the beginning of the second wave, and we all knew that the second wave was coming.
Yeah.
Because the history tells us that there have been 10 pandemics in the last 250 years. Every single one of them has had a second wave. I mean, we talk about the Spanish flu, but there have been others, and they've all had a second wave. So surprise, surprise, here we are with a second wave. So knowing this, it actually makes me look around and then see groups of people without masks in the park. And I'm just thinking, it gets quite frustrating, and you have to dissociate yourself a little bit, because otherwise you can get quite het up And I did for a little while, just saying, why are these people doing this? It then led me on in all sorts of interesting ways. So I really started getting interested in the philosophy of human nature and human nature's and behavior in terms of the adaptable nature of the human being, and how the reason why we're all over the globe is that we're incredibly adaptable as a species. But what that means is that when something new comes along, you kind of rapidly absorb that as normality. So we now have a lockdown that we're talking about in the spring and the summer. We have a lockdown and people have just sort of adapted to it and it's become the new normal. And then people start stretching the rules because they can't see the immediate effect of the virus and the people and the community around them. So, and that's human nature, and it's absolutely human nature. And I've started reading sort of about what they call epistemology, the validity or rationality of belief structures, and read a fascinating book called The Heretics by Will Storr. It's about how, in the face of all the facts, how why do some people believe something that can be clearly not true, like the Flat Earth Society or something like that, where all the facts say that the world is round or very nearly round, but there are people who are absolutely convinced, despite whatever facts you say, that it is flat. But in the same way here, there are still people who think that COVID-19 is a hoax. There are still people who think that it just won't affect them. And it, you kind of want to show them an ICU full of COVID patients. You know, you're thinking, what is it that you can do to make these people realize that what they're doing is inherently dangerous and slowing our ability to get out of this situation? The other thing, unfortunately, that this book suggests, The Heretics, is that it doesn't matter what you say. If the belief structure is that this is a hoax, whatever you put in front of that person, they will double down and say, that kind of reinforces my belief that this is a hoax. That's exactly what you would say. You know, so it's led me off into all sorts of interesting areas of reading about sort of epidemiology and epistemology and things. And maybe a little bit more understanding on my behalf about just the nature of human behavior. It's been really fascinating.
Wow, that's amazing that it's taken you down that path. I too am absolutely astounded at how people feel that the COVID-19 is a hoax, and they can think it's a conspiracy theory against them. I just think it's absolutely amazing.
And people are making it up on a grand scale, and I think that's, I mean, it's fascinating to think how they come to that conclusion. But
yeah,
but you know, it doesn't help us right now.
No. And it, you know, when we're at work, it is a bit like being in a parallel universe. All the new PPE that we have to wear and all the different measures that we have to put in place.
Absolutely.
So, as you say, we're adaptable, and we've just had to deal with those things. And as the whole general population, everyone's just adopted masks generally really quite well. So
It's good. That's the positive side of the adaptability. So now everyone's just wearing masks, and it looks a bit weird if you're on a train and someone isn't wearing a mask. You just feel a bit uneasy, because actually that's what we should be doing, and everyone's adapted to it. So that's a really positive side of it.
Yeah.
But there's also the negative side that, you know, that I've been reading about, of course.
Yeah. So talking about PPE, have you changed your practice because you've had the infection? Has it changed your thinking about, you know, wearing PPE, having had it? Or have you changed anything about your interaction with patients having experienced COVID-19?
Yeah, this is a really interesting area. I mean, the knee-jerk reaction, and it's almost certainly the right reaction in the first instance, is, you know, we've got a very transmissible virus. It's very contagious, and there is a whole period of asymptomatic spread. And so, of course, what one needs to do is to stop that completely by doing the full PPE. And we all know about the scramble for PPE at the beginning of the first wave. And I think we're in a great position now, because we do have the right equipment. And thanks to yourself, of course, with the viral filters and headsets and the full headgear, which makes me look like an alien. But it's
or an astronaut.
You're breathing purified air, and there's no viral particles in there, and that's really reassuring. I have to say that a bit of me got a bit blasé because I thought, well, I've had it. I managed to get a blood test, an antibody test, and I was strongly positive IgG and IgM. So it was fairly. It was about 5-6 weeks after I initially had the infection, and I was really strongly positive. Mm. And so I didn't get blasé to the point where, oh, I'm not wearing anything, but I was just kind of ticking it over, thinking, do I need to do this? I'm probably fine. There's another bit of me saying, well, I could probably still get it and give it to someone, so I'm still putting it on. And then, of course, our trust did testing for everyone, antibody testing for everyone eventually, and this is about 3 or 4 months after I had it, and all my antibodies are gone, which is now what we're seeing, you know, in large numbers. We're also seeing, so then I started thinking, oh, right, I really could get it again, and it might be worse next time. So, you know, I've got to protect my family, I've got to protect my patients, I've got to protect myself. And so then I hadn't actually changed. I was still doing the PPE, but I made sure I was being fastidious about it in a way that perhaps, again, human nature, you're thinking, well, I'm still seeing the patients over and over and over, and things will slip here and there, and you're not 100% right and doing all these things. But then I got back on track after that second antibody test, and I went, you've got to do this absolutely right and lead by example. So in terms of seeing patients face-to-face, and especially in laryngology, where we are looking in the noses and mouths and down into the throats on a regular basis, we're at high risk. So you've got to do the right thing. And I've become very comfortable with that. What's been really interesting as well is looking into the immunity. There was just something that came out a couple of days ago. It's yet to go through peer review, but there's a Birmingham Centre professor, Paul Moss, I think it is. They're looking at the T cell immunity, and there is a suggestion that can last a sort of 6 months or even up to 10 years. So I'll be really interested to see that paper when it actually comes out, when it gets through peer review. But actually, that makes me feel a bit more optimistic about long-lasting immunity.
Mm. Maybe I've been looking at the wrong bit.
Could be. I mean, what I've come to the conclusion, speaking to my intensive care colleagues and my experience myself, and then looking at the numbers as I've got more interested in them, is that in the words of a colleague of mine, Richard Breeze, who's ICU lead at Lewisham, he said, anyone who knows anything about this virus says that the moment you think you know what it's going to do, it does something else. It's really unpredictable. So the more people, the more data we get, the better we can treat it. The longer we get down this path, the more we're going to know about the immunity from it. But until we actually have that, we have to be safe. The unpredictable nature of the virus means that maybe those traditional protocols for surgeries and airway management may not be appropriate. They might be right, but they may not be appropriate. So prospective, we have to be very, Hunterian in our principles about prospectively collecting data and auditing our numbers really, really carefully. And that goes from surgery, surgical techniques, our health, our PPE, the way we split up the hospital into geographical zones, clean zones and amber zones and red zones. It's going to be really tough. And I've steeled myself mentally for, next 6 months of being just a fairly relentless slog in a way that the first wave was a fairly sharp peak. I think this next 4 to 6 months may be fairly relentless. And I think we need to just be prepared and just be on the money with our PPE, with our techniques and our data collection.
Well said. It's really the Russian roulette nature of the COVID-19 is the most kind of scary thing for me, I think.
Absolutely. I think that's well put. Yeah.
Can hit anybody at any time. So Well, thank you so much for joining us today, sharing your experience of real personal journey through COVID-19.
It's an absolute pleasure. No, it's been great. Always say if anyone wants to contact me, then please do so, as it's absolutely not a problem at all. But I think these podcasts have been brilliant, and long may they last.
Do you have any take-home messages for anyone listening?
I think I'll just go back to what I said right at the end. I said, be vigilant. Don't let things slide. Lead by example in terms of PPE and your practice in the hospital. And keep data. There are lots of very big international databases with COVID surgery, COVID airways, the BLA group with COVID airways, tracheostomy groups, and so on and so forth. And submit data. Submit the more data we can get, the better the outcomes and the better treatment options we're going to have.
Thank you very much, Nick. Thank you for being such a great leader and mentor. And thanks for joining us on this BLA podcast.
Absolute pleasure.
We hope you've enjoyed listening. This has been BLA Connections, a clear voice. I've been your host, Natalie Watson. You can listen to this podcast where you listen to podcasts and find all our episodes on our app, BLA Connect. Please feel free to email with any topics you would like us to explore, any questions you have, along with any suggested experts you would like to hear from. Also, if you would like to contribute to these podcasts, please email inquiries@britishlaryngological.org. Thank you for listening, and we hope you have found our podcast informative. Please remember to subscribe and do leave a review with your podcast provider. We do appreciate your likes, subscribes, and reviews.